You're listening to Deviant, a true crime podcast. I'm Mishka.
And I am Husband Sadov.
And this week we're covering the case of Stephen Griffiths, the crossbow cannibal.
The crossbow cannibal?
Yeah.
Well, this'll be fun.
I thought you might know this one, to be honest, because I know you've got a bit of a sort of morbid fascination with cannibals.
Well, it's an interesting hobby I'd like to explore.
Just to say it here and now, spoiler alert, I'm not sure he was a cannibal.
Oh. My interest has just gone wrong.
Oh, no, you are going to... I think you're going to properly hate this guy.
Well, yeah, he didn't eat them. Is what you're saying.
You know how sometimes sort of I say, well, I don't have sympathy for, you know, murderers, but I have the sympathy that a child that they used to be or whatever. Mm-hmm. I have no sympathy or empathy or feeling of any kind for this guy.
Just a piece of shit through and through.
Massive piece of shit.
Okay.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. How are we all?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm really tired.
You are.
I'm so tired.
I think people are going to notice at this point you're pretty tired.
It seems to be often. Common occurrence.
Yeah.
If this episode has gone up maybe a day late, maybe I'm so sorry in advance. I'm going to try and get it out on time. But in the last 48 hours, I have slept 1 hour when I was meant to, and about 1.5 broken up into small snippets during the day.
Why?
Because I am extremely anxious about moving house.
We're moving house?
We are moving house, and it is keeping me up literally all night at the moment.
Oh.
So, if this one is, I'm going to do my best to get it out on the Friday, but it might be right at the very end of the Friday.
Mishka will try and whip it out regardless.
I don't think we have any corrections this week, do we?
Logan texted me. Yeah, he did. He does listen at work.
Oh, I thought as much. Hi, Logan.
Hello.
And hello, all of our listeners.
Yeah.
We made it to Australia this week. We have somebody in Sydney, Australia, who's listening.
Oh, so we've made
really
it.
Which is really cool.
Pretty sure we've been in Polegate and Crawley.
You're such a dad humorist.
Yeah.
You're not even a father, but you're so ready to be one. Yeah. Hello, Australia. Hello, everywhere else in the world. Hello, South Africa. Hello, France. Hello, Russia. Hello, Denmark. Hello, Britain. Hello, America. Hello, Sweden. Hello, Finland.
Hello, Luxembourg.
I don't think they're in Luxembourg.
No. They're hiding. They're using the VPN. No one knows what Luxembourg is.
No, I don't. I'm really uneducated. I'm sorry to anybody in Luxembourg. I don't really know how to find the next town over without, well, let's be honest, without a GPS on a mobile shouting at me.
Yeah. And to be fair, I do the driving.
Yes, so you do the driving, so I don't have to pay attention to things like directions. As you probably can hear, I particularly am very excited at how international we are becoming with our listener base. It's awesome. Thank you so much, everybody. It's really cool. And I will try and reflect the fact that we have people all over the world by trying to pick cases from all over the world in episodes going forward. I've got a few ideas.
Because Mira, for example.
Yes, one of our friends / listeners.
One of our beta listeners.
Yes, she is a beta, definitely.
Hey, Mira. She's got a few cases she told us about before. We have no goddamn clue what she's talking about. So hopefully we're going to get some exciting, interesting cases from her little part of the world and beyond.
Yeah, and I will need lots of help with pronunciation because they're from Central Europe. Anyway, thank you very much to everyone that's downloading. Please continue to tell your friends and spread us across the world because it's the closest thing that we can do to international travel these days.
Yeah.
And said after that piffle puffle, shall we get into the case?
You go on then.
Okie dokie. The law on sex work in the UK is muddy. Although it is not illegal for consenting adults to exchange money for sexual acts, almost everything else outside the financial exchange is. It is not technically illegal for sex workers to solicit. However, it is a criminal offence to do so on the street. It is also illegal to pay for sex with someone who is under another's control for the controller's own gain. And it is illegal to either manage or work within a brothel. By definition, a brothel is a location, such as a house or business, which has more than one sex worker operating within. To put it bluntly, the only way that a sex worker in the UK can do business legally is alone, and this means more often than not, from their own home. The laws on sex work are supposedly aimed at restricting the activities of clients rather than the sex workers, as well as tackling the issues of sexual slavery and human trafficking. But in reality, it is the workers who suffer because of these overly aggressive restrictions. These laws mean that countless vulnerable people, majority women, are forced to do business alone, without the safety and support of others, without any legal rights, and often without a physically safe place to go. There are no employment laws to protect sex workers. There are no health and safety regulations. There is no management structure or security beyond pimps, which is, you know, they're dickheads in and of their own. So basically, there is nothing legally in place to monitor sex workers' well-being, which is, in my opinion, absolutely fucking appalling. It is not the customers that are being punished by our laws. It is the people providing a paid service that, while apparently not illegal, has been so severely restricted by the law that their options for a safe working environment are all but non-existent. If a crime is committed against a sex worker during a meeting and they attempt to report it to police, there is a high risk that this person, despite being the victim, will also face legal ramifications, even if they aren't taken seriously. If a woman is assaulted by a client during a meeting and she picked the client up on the street, she has broken the law. She may even face harsher punitive actions than the person who assaulted her. It's no surprise that sex workers who are victims of violence and other crimes are unlikely to report them. UK law has effectively created a black hole around sex workers. They are overlooked, devalued, and underprotected. If they are killed, they are often seen as being less dead than other people. Their names mean less to many than their profession, and too often the attitude is, well, what did she expect? As if somehow they deserved what happens to them because of their work. A stance that strips them of their identity and makes their lives have less meaning. They are not seen as spouses, parents, siblings, someone who is loved and more than just their job. This attitude is something that was abused by one man in the late 2000s in Bradford, Yorkshire. A man that studied serial killers and their methods full time and who wanted to best all of them. He targeted sex workers and took the lives of at least three, certain that little would be done to investigate their disappearances and deaths. He was obsessed with the lore of killers who came before him, such as Jack the Ripper and Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, and gave himself his own sensationalised moniker for the headlines, the Crossbow Cannibal. His real name was Stephen Sean Griffiths. I'm really surprised that this is not ringing any bells.
No.
I bet it will later when they get to how they catch it. Mm-hmm. This guy is the most ginormous fanny.
Okay.
And just to kind of put it into context for you as well, because if you're not in the UK, you're probably not aware of what Bradford is like. Bradford is a city in the sort of mid to north area of England, and it's in Yorkshire, but it's part of Yorkshire that basically came out of the Industrial Revolution. And it has a reputation of being one of the most highly criminalised areas of the country. And I work in the insurance industry, and I happen to know that things like the rate of car theft are so high in Bradford that it is the worst rated insurance area in the entirety of the UK. Huh. Interesting little fact for you.
Yeah.
So there are parts of it that are really nice because you get out of the immediate city centre and you suddenly get into like the Yorkshire Dales. But the very centre of the area is, it's got issues.
Yeah, it's also quite known for it's a very, very multicultural place.
Yeah, it's very multicultural.
And there's a lot of tension about it.
Yeah, especially now, there's a lot of racial tension. There's other sort of high profile crimes that have occurred in the area. People like Peter Sutcliffe, the West Yorkshire Ripper, where in Bradford, they've had their share of serial killers. They've had their share of serial rapists. There is a lot of issues in the history of Bradford. So that just kind of gives you a litmus test on the kind of environment that Stephen Griffiths was operating in.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad people. Hashtag not all, obviously.
No, there's lots of lovely people there as well. But
we've already established in the previous episode we would never generalise an entire place or people.
No.
But
statistically, it has problems.
Yeah.
It has problems.
Statistically, there's quite a few arseholes.
Mm-hmm. Just in terms of the crime rate there. And the poverty rate in a lot of areas as well. There's highly impoverished areas of Bradford. Stephen Griffiths was born on December 24th, 1969, the first child of frozen food salesman Stephen Griffiths Sr. and a telephonist Moira. She was secretly a con artist who would later be convicted of fraud.
What is it with con artists?
Honestly, we need to sort out these serial killer bingo cards.
Yeah, there are so many con artists in this series.
The couple divorced when Griffiths was only 13, leaving him and his siblings with his mother. Griffiths attended the Queen Elizabeth Grammar School from ages 13 to 16, the same school as John George Haig, the acid bath murderer.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Griffiths learned about Haig while he was at school, including the desk that the school supposedly kept in the basement with the famous serial killer's initials carved upon it.
Why do they keep it?
People keep weird shit when it comes to murderers. Like, there's murderabilia collectors and all sorts of things out there. I think that's a major step too far, in my opinion. But people keep all sorts of weird shit in relation to murder. Griffiths was considered intelligent by his teachers, but as many school reports have shown, not just his, he did not apply himself. I've had reports that said that. Michelle is very bright, but often does not apply herself to the full extent of her abilities.
Same.
AKA, she's a bit of a lazy fuck.
Yeah, I had the same, because I was like,
I will not engage with anything that doesn't interest me is the problem.
Yeah.
So, yes, that's basically a diplomatic way of saying lazy bastard. During his years at school, Griffiths was fascinated by martial arts and weaponry and would carry knives and kung fu magazines in his bag to class. Yeah.
This fucking kung fu magazine.
Yeah. And I love that that's the bit that you've picked up on, not the fact that, you know, he was walking around with stuff like, you know, switchblades and shuriken in his briefcase.
Well, he didn't say shuriken.
Yeah, he also used to carry shuriken and stuff.
I went to school in Crawley.
This is true.
Quite a lot of people went to school with carried knives.
Yeah, that's not outside the norm for your childhood, I suppose, is it?
But it's just a minute picture of him just sitting down at his desk, opens his bag, gets his karate magazine, pops it on the desk. And just sitting there, his arms folded, like, yeah, I know kung fu.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. Accurate.
With everyone sits there going,
he's a bit weird.
Fucking Batman, what are you doing?
Griffiths enjoyed playing tabletop role-playing games, where he would play savage warrior archetype characters, a stark contrast to his own below average size.
I bet he played a fucking murder hobo.
I think he played like barbarians and stuff.
No, as in literally like, you walk into the tavern, there's blah blah, I stab the first person I see.
Oh my god. Yeah, those kind of people are so annoying in a campaign.
There's 4chan threads from D&D stories. Mm-hmm. These people are referred to as that guys, where they just try and be too much themselves.
Yeah.
And they're assholes. Yeah. So it's not good for anyone.
This is that sounds very accurate. This guy's got a major case of the tryhards.
Yeah.
Less amusing though. Griffiths also had a habit of killing and dissecting small animals and birds.
How did I know that was literally going to be the next thing?
Because there are certain markers for the vast majority of dangerous psychopaths and serial killers in their early childhood.
Was it cats as well?
It was birds and mice and things like that.
Okay.
Basically, you've got something, it's kind of debunked now to a degree in terms that it's a sweeping assessment, but there's this psychological theory called the McDonald's triad, yeah, which is three big red flags in early childhood that you have got a potential serial killer on your hands, and that is bedwetting, cruelty to animals, and setting fires. So if you see any of these behaviors, particularly like bedwetting, the thing is that bedwetting could be from all sorts of things, but it's like bedwetting in later years, so sort of in teens.
Mm-hmm.
But if you see any of these behaviours in early childhood, it's something that really needs to be dealt with there and then, or you could have a very serious problem on your hands in later life.
What was it? Bedwetting?
Bedwetting, setting fires, cruelty to animals.
Right, okay.
So PSA for you guys. Griffiths would also watch his mother have sex with boyfriends that she brought home after her divorce when she brought them home without her knowledge. So he used to spy on her. She would do things like she'd take the boyfriends out to the garden so that the kids weren't around it, and sort of have a nice evening under the stars. And Griffiths would watch her from the age of sort of 13.
Fucking weird.
Mm-hmm. So we're also getting an issue of being exposed to and sort of malinformed about sex and relationships from a very early age. By 17 years old, Griffiths had left school without completing his higher education. So I think he got his GCSEs, but he didn't go any further, even though he was perfectly capable of doing so. It's not for everybody, but he didn't have any interest is the thing. After he left school, he spent virtually all of his time alone, isolating himself from his family and seemingly without friends. He would hang around town without any real purpose or design and would amuse himself by shoplifting. Stealing, another red flag.
Mm-hmm.
On one occasion in the spring of 1987, Griffiths was caught shoplifting by the manager of a supermarket. Griffiths was armed with a knife, and when the man tried to stop him, he slashed the man across his face and throat. Fortunately, the store manager survived, though he did require 19 stitches. So that seems, you know, like a totally appropriate response to somebody trying to stop you nicking biscuits. Griffiths was arrested after this incident, and on the 23rd of June 1987, Leeds Crown Court sentenced him to 3 years in custody. While imprisoned, he was given extensive psychiatric evaluations that found him to have a personality disorder, but not to be mentally ill. Rather, he was prone to abnormal thoughts and behaviours that, in psychiatrist opinion, could not be helped by medical treatment. Griffiths was released after serving just half his sentence on grounds of good behaviour. Basically, they declared him basically colloquially a psychopath. And despite that, he got out in less than half of his full term with no kind of follow-up monitoring. Just...
why?
As we like to say, so many ball drops.
Yeah.
While he was incarcerated, Griffiths had lost contact with his family, going so far as to express an outright hatred for his mother, Moira. While her son was away in prison, Moira had been suffering with depression herself. She stopped working, and although she had in excess of £50,000 in savings, she began claiming multiple benefits, including housing benefit and council tax relief. Ultimately, Moira was convicted of fraud, which likely contributed to Griffith's utter contempt of her and his self-imposed exile from his family. So he just loved looking down his nose at her, even though I'd just like to point out, for the remainder of his life, Stephen Griffiths never ever does an honest day's work. He never has a job. After leaving prison in 1988, Griffiths moved into a small council flat in Manningham, an industrial area of Bradford, and just a few hundred yards away from where Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, killed one of his first victims, something that Griffiths was well aware of. He also enrolled in Bradford College to study psychology. During the 80s, forensic psychology and behavioural analysis was becoming more widely known, thanks to high-profile arrests by Scotland Yard investigators that had used psychological profiling as part of their investigation, and the fictional works of Thomas Harris, the writer of the Hannibal Lecter book series. In Harris's books, two FBI agents from the Behavioural Analysis Unit, so that's Clarice Starling and Will Graham, big fan of Thomas Harris, use profiling to capture serial killers that are composites inspired by several real-life murderers. But more than this, the title character of the books, Hannibal Lecter, is not only a serial killer and cannibal, but also the best profiler of them all, being a highly decorated psychiatrist, and he used this profiling to help him commit his crimes. To Griffiths, this relatively new area of criminology was an opportunity to study the sort of violence that he was fascinated with, but use the guise of academia to cover it up as a normal interest. He was quick to tell his tutors of his desire to become a forensic psychologist, and showed a willingness to study that he had not shown previously. So he's suddenly gone from being this sort of lazy, disengaged student as a teenager to being well up for doing his coursework.
You're checking out a load of books about serial killers from the library. Yeah,
literally. However, Griffiths, despite his renewed interest in his education...
So where did he do that? Bradford College?
Bradford College, yeah.
And surely if he's done time, they should be aware of that, right?
No, there's no checks required.
Really?
At this point, there's no checks required. Yep, nothing in terms of his criminal background and nothing in terms of his psychological background. No disclosures necessary.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And just to put a cap on it, the government is paying for his education. Griffiths, despite his renewed interest in his education, was incapable of keeping out of legal trouble. In 1989, he was sentenced to 100 hours of community service after he was found to be in possession of an air pistol. He had previously used the pistol to shoot birds from his flat window, which he had then also dissected. Being in possession of the weapon was in violation of the terms of his probation, but Griffiths was not returned to prison, only given the community service hours. So although he violated his probation, and really, he should have gone back in the clink, they were like, we'll let you off with a slap on the wrist. You're not really doing any harm. Meanwhile, he's shooting pigeons and stuff. Bastard.
He didn't even eat them, either.
Well, he might have, who knows.
Pigeon's not bad.
I really want to try pigeon, but like in a nice high-end restaurant.
Oh, yeah.
With like some nice blackberry sauce and some fondant potatoes.
Pear.
That's the one they do with it, is it?
When I had it was with pigeon and pear.
That sounds really nice.
Fancy word thing. It was in a bowl.
It's a nice game chip. Like some sort of fatty, crispy potato to go with it because it's really gamey, isn't it?
Yeah, it was in the was a little pub in... Actually, went there when this one I was still living with the parents, Liam and Cindy.
Oh, nice.
And went there for a little Christmas dinner.
Nice.
Yeah.
So you'll eat pigeon, but you won't eat black pudding?
I love black pudding. I tried it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Fair enough. I thought it was just that you were put off by what was in it.
No, not at all. I eat haggis.
Haggis.
And I'll tell you where I tasted it. In Dublin. Full Irish breakfast.
Oh, it would have been really good black pudding as well, then.
Full Irish breakfast comes with white pudding and black pudding.
In May of 1991, Stephen Griffiths was arrested again for holding a knife to a young woman's throat while he was at college.
Let me guess, even though this was a breach of his probation, he didn't go back in the clink.
Oh, no, he did.
Oh,
he did.
Plot twist, everyone. Yeah.
So this young lady had been with a group of three other friends, and Griffiths had basically gone past them while they were attending college and imagined that they were laughing at him. So he decided that the appropriate response was to hold her up with a knife against her throat. Fortunately, he didn't actually hurt her. He just frightened the bejesus out of her and then just walked away. And then when the girl's father later on went after Griffiths looking for an explanation as to why he was such a prick, Griffiths also pulled the knife on him and threatened him with it. So luckily, the girl's father brought charges against him, and Griffiths was charged with affray and possession of a weapon, sentenced this time to 2 years in Leeds prison in January of 1992.
But how much did he serve?
Well,
2 weeks?
A little bit more than that, but not much.
3 weeks.
While he was in prison, again, he had psychiatric assessments, and they found him sane and, again, suffering from a personality disorder. They called it schizoid personality disorder at the time. I think that might be an outdated term now. And, again, they said that they couldn't help him with any form of treatment. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a medical professional. I'm pretty sure that although medications may not be effective for sort of things like borderline personality disorder and social antisocial personality disorder, I'm pretty sure that regular counselling and talk therapy can help manage it. But just throwing someone away without any sort of aftercare saying, we can't do anything for you, doesn't seem like the appropriate response. While in prison, Griffith's obsession with violence and murder only got worse. He enthusiastically discussed other inmates' offences with them whenever he could, as well as known serial killers, and told one of the prison officers there once, quote, "What Sutcliffe did was nothing. I'm going to outdo him. He was a pussycat compared to me." We're going to cover Peter Sutcliffe at some point, but he was known as the West Yorkshire Ripper, or the Yorkshire Ripper, I think, and basically he killed lots of sex workers and got away with it for years because the police totally bungled the investigation. And they interviewed him something like 9 times and still didn't nick him. They had lots and lots of opportunities to stop him killing and they didn't. Despite his obsession with murder and his freewheeling discussion of it, Griffiths did not serve his full sentence this time either, and was released a year early in 1993 as the result of good behaviour.
Really?
Yep.
Okay, so you've got someone who he keeps getting thrown the clink.
Yep.
For pulling knives on people.
For being very violent, yep.
Like pulling knives on people. His first time in prison was for slashing someone in the face, yep, and on the throat.
Yeah.
And then,
and it's a miracle that he didn't kill the guy, to be honest.
He shoots birds regularly, yep, for dissection, not, yep, for hunting. No problem with hunting birds and eating them, but just doing it.
No, because, just for fun, because it's a cruel and nasty thing to do.
And then he spends a lot of his time in prison discussing murderers and saying, "Oh, I'm going to be the very best, yep, the best there ever was." Bum, bum, bum.
Yep.
But the parole board were like, "You know what? He's a good lad.
He's such a good boy.
He's such a good boy. Let's let him out. Mm-hmm. Let's just put a knife in his hand and be like, we trust you. What's the worst that can happen?"
Mm-hmm. Yep. I know. My face hurts from the just utter disbelief grimace that I'm pulling.
This is really stupid.
Griffiths, after he left prison in 1993, continued his studies and began collecting, just like he predicted, many books, as in hundreds, about serial killers in order to study them in a more efficient manner. Griffiths mainly focused on Jack the Ripper, the Moors murderers, the acid bath murderer, and his personal favourite, the Yorkshire Ripper. And I'm not saying that everybody who collects books on true crime is a psychopath. I have lots. But I also don't go around telling people how fabulous Peter Sutcliffe was and how I want to be just like him when I grow up. Your face. Your face. You just look so done already. It's like a roadmap, isn't it?
It's not a roadmap. It's a road. Basically, for the getting to the point of going, you know what? I don't think this guy's particularly right. He might do something bad.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to connect certain dots.
Mm-hmm. There's got to be.
This is a spider web.
Yep. Well, it's not a spider web, but it's a straight line.
Well, no, it's just all these different things all pulled together. It's multiple lines all going into one spot.
You'll never guess what I'm going to say next.
He ate spiders?
No.
What?
In October 1994, Griffiths was again arrested for carrying a knife in public. Again, he only received probation despite his previous criminal history. Guys, come on.
Bradford has a lot of problems.
Bradford has a lot of problems, and I think at the time they probably felt like they had bigger fish to fry.
This is
the issue. There were so many issues and problems in the area, and there's just not the manpower to deal with it all. Somehow, despite all of this running around with pointy things being a general dickhead, he managed to complete his course in psychology. And in 1997, he'd enrolled to study a degree in psychology at Leeds University. And he moved to Flat 33, Homefield Court, which would become a very notorious location.
How?
He continued his collection of true crime memorabilia and horror books and films, really nasty, under-the-counter kind of films, as well as collecting weapons such as samurai swords and crossbows. He liked to dress in black with a long leather trench coat.
Oh, are you serious?
Yeah, well, this is the thing, like...
What a tip.
He might just be a weirdo. I know... I grew up in the goth... I grew up in the goth subculture, and I knew lots of kind of weirdos just like this. Just because you're a weirdo doesn't mean that you're a murderer. Unfortunately, this guy wanted to be a murderer, and therefore decided to turn himself into all these stereotypes of a quote-unquote weirdo to fit the kind of mystique that he wanted to give himself.
He's a prick.
He's a bellend. Griffiths also kept pet lizards, which he would often take out for walks on Leeds, or took out to clubs with him in a rucksack, which actually, that's quite cute. I love reptiles. What? Your face?
This is ridiculous.
Also, are you just annoyed with him for being a posing prick?
Oh, he's a massive prick. It also reminded me of something else. Something I saw recently. There's a nightclub.
Uh-huh.
Everyone's dancing and everyone's cheering because there's a guy walking through the middle of the dance floor with a goat over his shoulder. Oh. And everyone's like, yeah, it's a goat!
Oh, that goat must have been so stressed.
No, he was like, hey, everyone.
Meh.
What's going on?
Meh.
You listen to shit music.
He must have been so stressed, that poor little critter.
Because everyone knows that goats prefer to listen to Mongolian throat singing. It's a fact. It's a fact.
Have you ever seen those fainting goats?
Everyone's seen the fainting goats.
They're so
goats.
Cute.
And the screaming goats.
They're so cute. The fainting goats are just adorable. Like, they're just like, oh, I had a mild surprise.
It's a panic reaction.
Yeah, it's something like, they have a really sudden and brief dip in blood pressure, and it is a panic reaction. I think it's a genetic defect. It's not supposed to happen. It doesn't do them any harm, but the slightest little surprise, like you sneeze loudly, and these little tiny little things will all just suddenly get there. Griffiths also began dating during this period, and he would go to goth clubs and bars to meet women. And he's such a poser, and he has the world's worst perm at this point. There's pictures of him. He's got long hair down to his shoulders in a ringlet perm, and he used to tie the front of it back in like a top knot, and then he'd slick it all with baby oil to make it lay smooth, and then he'd wear like this puppy Victorian shirt and his big leather trench coat, and he doesn't look comfortable in it, is the thing. It doesn't look natural, and he just looks like the biggest toss part. Ugh, the kind of guy that if you asked to buy you a drink in a bar, you'd be like, get away from me, or I'm going to grab between your legs and twist. Such a pose. I'll show you some great vanity shots that he had done. Like, here's my headshot.
You just want to give him a slap.
Yeah, he seems like the guy, kind of guy that is so smarmy, just oozing grace. At first, Griffiths could appear charming and intelligent to the women that met him, flirting easily. But as the relationships developed, his true nature was revealed and he would become abusive. One girlfriend recalled how she would wake up in the middle of the night to find Griffiths awake and staring down at her silently, which is so creepy. When the girlfriend broke up with him, Griffiths shoved a graphic book about the crimes of David Berkowitz, the son of Sam. But yeah, he shoved this really grisly true crime book about the son of Sam through her front door, and basically it was clearly a threat.
The crimes of David Bowie, 500 pages, and they're all crotch shots of the Goblin King.
That's not a crime. That can never be a crime. Oh, Jareth.
Focus.
You can't be cross with me from getting distracted. You're the one who brought up the David crime. Bowie.
You're the one that said the
velveteen tights.
You're the one that started it. You started talking about the crimes of David Bowie.
They're making a sequel. Like, they're actually doing it, apparently, finally. I don't know how they're going to replace him. I think the only person that I'd genuinely be up for playing Jareth instead of David Bowie would be Tilda Swinton.
Hmm?
Yeah. She's very good at these sort of androgynous roles. She'd be amazing. Another girlfriend, Zita Pinder, met Griffiths through a Lonely Hearts column in a paper in 1998. She recalled him as seeming sweet and charming, and on their first date, he gave him a photograph of himself that he'd had professionally made. Such a poser!
What the fuck?
Right? And she basically laughed at it at the time and thought he was kind of a weirdo, but thought it was a joke almost, rather than being, oh my god. Here's my headshot, pass it to your agent. Such a weirdo!
Who does that?
I don't know, but she carried on seeing him, so she must have just thought he was funny.
Just to say, dating advice, people. Let's do the dating
don't
advice. Don't turn up to your first date with a headshot.
And this headshot is amazing. It is in black and white, and it's him in his full like Anne Rice vampiric regalia with his bad perm resting on his chin, like, you know, Rodin's The Thinker, and sort of smiling in what he must imagine is a sultry way at the camera. And he just looks like every failed actor ever. Like, if you turned up for the first time I met you with a picture like that, I would laugh in your face, buy you a tub of moisturising lotion to take home with you, and be on my way.
Good job I didn't have a headshot then, eh?
Yeah, but Zita Pinder, as I say, she really liked him, and they went out for 2 years.
So she just thought, you kooky motherfucker.
Yeah, she thought he was just funny and weird. Despite having his own flat, Griffiths...
And his own headshots.
Yeah. Griffiths told Zita that he still lived with his parents, and that he was training to be a counsellor for people with, quote-unquote, problems. Not that he had an interest in criminal psychology. Though they had an active sex life while they were together, Griffiths could not climax during intercourse, even after he tried for hours. He also had strange habits, like he couldn't sleep without stuffing balls of cotton wool into his ears because he had an irrational fear that during the night insects would crawl into them.
What?
Yep. And he didn't like to be physically affectionate unless it was on his terms. So one night Zita had tried to basically just stroke his hair like I do with you. And when she touched his hair, he pushed her violently away and threatened her with, you know, if you ever do that again, I'll kill you. When they watched horror movies together, Griffiths, rather than being disturbed or afraid, would laugh hysterically whenever anybody was hurt or killed in the films.
To be fair, with some modern horror, it is laughable.
Sam Raimi makes me laugh.
Oh yeah, Sam Raimi does funny horror.
But, okay, put it this way. I have only ever seen one of the Saw movies. It was Saw 3. I was made to go into... I'm a massive horror nerd, but I don't like violence for violence sake. I was made to go and watch Saw 3 by an ex in the cinema. I wanted to leave the cinema. I was so disturbed by it and I was not allowed to. That is the kind of thing that Stephen Griffiths would just sit and laugh at. I was absolutely nauseated by it. I thought it was disgusting, but Stephen Griffiths would find something like that hilarious.
See, I laughed at that film just for how stupid it was.
I couldn't get over how disgustingly... I don't like slasher movies. Yeah. I'm much more into psychological horror. Well, and I love a good exorcism movie.
Oh, you love exorcism
movies. I love a good demon movie. Exorcism of Emily Rose. Amazing film. Not even really a horror, but in some ways, but very frightening. Getting wildly off track.
Yeah.
When, after 2 years together, Griffiths revealed that he did in fact have his own flat to Zita, he took her over there and she was so disturbed by his collection of hundreds of books on murderers and his collection of weapons that she feigned feeling sick so that Griffiths would take her home. The next day she broke up with him from the safety of her own home over the telephone. Smart lady. The pair actually parted on good terms, with Griffiths just accepting her decision, and they never spoke again. She never heard anything from him again. There were no ramifications. She was so lucky. Others, however, were not so fortunate. One woman, while she slept, had boiling water poured over her stomach by Stephen Griffiths. Yeah. Another girlfriend, Kathy Hancock, was abused dreadfully by him. Kathy had two dogs that she loved, but Griffiths hated. One day, the dogs just disappeared. Griffiths claimed that he had given them away, but given his history of killing animals... On another occasion, he tried to poison Kathy with a dangerous cocktail of antidepressant medications. She had her stomach pumped and fortunately survived. Griffiths systematically isolated Kathy from her friends and family. When she lived with him, he would never allow her to leave the flat at Homefield Court without him. He was physically abusive, punching her in the face or headbutting her every time she even so much as tried to stand up for herself. In spring 2001, Kathy found out that she was pregnant, something that actually delighted Griffiths, which is unusual in domestic abuse cases. Normally the abuse escalates when a pregnancy comes into the picture because there is someone else that vies for the victim's attention, but Griffiths was up for it. He was really chuffed, and for a while the abuse actually seemed like it would stop and he became very doting on her. But a few months into the pregnancy, Kathy had complications. And she discovered that the pregnancy was ectopic. So an ectopic pregnancy is basically the fertilised egg doesn't make it down into the uterus, gets stuck in a fallopian tube. And rather than implanting in the uterus, it implants in the tube. And there is no such thing, as far as I'm aware, as a successful ectopic pregnancy. You either miscarry or you have to have the pregnancy terminated because it can kill you. When Kathy was going through the complications of her pregnancy, and ectopic pregnancies, as far as I'm aware, are also extraordinarily painful when you start to become symptomatic. It's a horrible, horrific thing to go through. He refused to go to the hospital with her, even while she was miscarrying. And when she got home from the hospital, the violence and the abusive behaviour immediately started again.
What a piece of shit.
What a piece of shit.
Could some of him be because, as you said before, like, he couldn't climax
for well,
hours? What if that the reason he acted out was because he kind of felt invalidated because his shit didn't work?
I don't think it's that. I think he's a sexual sadist, meaning that he can only achieve sexual gratification through violence and cruelty to others. So I think in a normal vanilla, shall we say, sexual relationship, he wasn't able to get off. But if he was violent and cruel to other people, such as the women in his life, right, that was arousing for him.
What a piece of shit.
Not a very nice man. Fortunately, Kathy was far stronger than Griffiths. She managed to leave him with the help of family and friends, staying with different people regularly to try and keep her violent ex from finding her. Unfortunately, he did stalk her relentlessly for years. He would do things like slash her tire, make threatening phone calls, and tell her that he was abusing his pets at home and that he would continue to do so and kill them if she did not return to him. He once killed two of her pet cats and spray-painted her house with vile graffiti, calling her things like a slag and a slapper. It took 10 years and multiple restraining orders and injunctions to get any peace from Griffiths. So he just tortured her. Bless her. You see what I mean? There is no redeeming quality in this
yeah.
bastard. None whatsoever. Griffiths began to drink heavily and developed some serious drug habits, using things like cocaine and amphetamines, which, fucking hell, speed will fuck you up. Alongside his attempts at long-term relationships, he also did business with sex workers and was well known to the community in Bradford, though a meeting with him could be a yo-yo experience. Sometimes when they met him, he would be kind, bringing them back to the flat and allowing them to use his bath, cooking them dinner, things like sausage, mash and beans, giving them clean clothes, and just generally being kind to them without wanting any sexual contact. And some of the girls in Bradford actually thought of Stephen Griffiths as a brother. He was so lovely to them, which is very bizarre. I think it's a power play. On the other hand, some girls would go home with Griffiths and he would become extremely violent, exploding with anger without warning, screaming how he had been ripped off by sex workers in the past and throwing girls out onto the street. So it was just luck of the draw with him. Unable to sustain any sort of healthy relationship, Griffiths buried himself deeper into his studies, completing his degree in psychology. He then went on to enrol for a PhD at the University of Bradford. His PhD was in local history. Griffiths basically manipulated the course, there's no other way to put it, to his interest by proposing a thesis entitled Homicide in Industrial City, Lethal Violence in Bradford from 1847 to 1899. So yeah, he did a PhD in local history and turned it into a study in murder.
Okay.
I mean, talk about bending the brief.
How many alarm bells did this at this point?
None. Because they still had no knowledge of his criminal or psychological history. Just to put the final cherry on top for you with this one. PhDs are enormously expensive to do.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that Griffiths did this local history one is because it was subsidised by the government and he didn't have to pay for it. Yep. Griffiths used this mask of academic interest to pursue his morbid hobby. He used to make multiple field trips, quote-unquote, such as multiple visits to the site of a canal in Bradford where a body had recently been found, and walking regularly around the perimeter wall of Wakefield Prison. Wakefield Prison is known as the Monster Mansion in the UK due to the criminals that have been incarcerated there, including Ian Huntley, Harold Shipman, and Ian Watkins. Do you know who Ian Watkins is?
No.
The former singer of the Lost Prophets. The baby rapist.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. That is one I will not cover.
No. And I think there's a lot of people that have the bloody band logo tattooed on them.
I know. Bless them. Griffiths also created MySpace pages. Dedicated, sorry, I can't help but laugh.
Fucking MySpace.
MySpace. I'm so cool. He created MySpace pages dedicated to his favourite serial killers and joined chat rooms and forums where he could discuss the merits of different methods of disposal for bodies and preferred murder weapons, indulging his obsession with online fantasy. He posted reviews on true crime literature, horror films, and photographs of his weapon collection, as well as selfies captioned with biblical verses such as, "And I will execute with great vengeance on them with furious rebukes, and they shall know that I am the Lord when I shall lay my vengeance on them." These selfies, now just to kind of, he's out of his Anne Rice stage at this point. And onto his back of the van, martial arts obsessed dad bod, possibly has gynecomastia, which is little man boobs. And he's posting these on his MySpace page, while basically referring to him as the angel of himself as the angel of death. It's really, really hard not to just laugh at his complete and utter assholery.
That is so 90s internet, though.
It is so 90s. He's such a fanny. All in all, his social media pages were an exercise in the veneration of violence and Griffith's own narcissism. His behaviour also worried staff within the block of flats at Holmfield Court. They worried that he was potentially violent.
Really?
Right? And after a series of threats were made by him against staff, the duty manager's office at the block was fitted with a panic button.
Really?
Yeah, they were that afraid of him. By 2009, Griffiths was no longer satisfied by his fantasies. Wanting to fulfil his warped ambitions of outdoing the serial killers that he so admired, he began a brutal murder campaign on some of Bradford's most vulnerable residents. The first victim was Susan Rushworth. Susan was 43 years old, a mother of three children and a grandmother. Her father was Barry and her mother Christine. Susan was the youngest of three children, with an older brother and sister. She grew up in Thornton, a village on the outskirts of Bradford, famed for its connections with the literary family of the Bronte sisters, and she had a happy and loving childhood. In 1983, at the age of 17, Susan suffered a massive brain hemorrhage, but miraculously she survived. She had to learn to speak again and to reuse the right side of her body. She was also left with epilepsy, which she would have to take medication for the rest of her life. But she made an outstanding overall recovery through hard work and a positive attitude. Her parents said she never complained once.
Hmm.
Never. Amazing. At 17 years old. Susan married in 1984 and gave birth to two of her three children. She absolutely adored being a mother, and all who knew her admired the care that she took of her kids. Unfortunately, her marriage did not last, and after the divorce in 1994, Susan moved with her children further into Bradford. Susan's siblings recalled her as being lonely after the divorce, and somewhat naive. And on the estate that Susan moved on to, she befriended other young mothers who were on their own there, who were also involved in the drug culture of Bradford. Susan had her third child while living on the estate, but the relationship with the father did not last. Susan's family suspect it was this boyfriend that introduced her to heroin, to which she sadly developed a severe addiction. She turned to sex work to fund her addiction, as did her teenage daughter later, who also developed the same heroin issues. Susan hated using heroin, though, describing it as an evil drug, and desperately wanted to be free from the vice grip of her addiction. Susan's family, wanting to help her in any way that they could, paid for her to go into rehab in the spring of 2009. She was there for 6 weeks, and after she came out, she was clean and no longer engaging in sex work. She moved into her parents' home once she came out of the clinic to help her mother care for her father, who by now was deep in the grip of dementia. Susan was hopeful and healthy again, planning for the future, able to do things like spend regular time with her children again, and was even hoping to take them on holiday with her parents in the following year. On the 22nd of June 2009, though, Susan Rushworth vanished. After celebrating Father's Day with her family, she had taken a bus into town to pick up her methadone prescription. On the way to the pharmacist, she'd stopped to visit a few friends and was due to meet one more, but she did not arrive to this final meeting. Her family never saw her again. When Susan did not return at the expected time from her trip into the town, her family tried to contact her, but her mobile phone was not switched on. By the 23rd of June, her family were worried enough to report her missing to the police. After a week, police released a media statement with limited details of her disappearance, not wanting her history of sex work and drug addiction to affect people's propensity to bring in tips. But by week two, there was no news, and police began to assume the worst. They blamed her history of drug addiction and sex work for her disappearance at first, but family insisted that even when she was at her worst, they had always known where she was, and police continued their investigation. They dredged local lakes and canals, but found no evidence of Susan. No leads came in from appeals to the public. Around Christmas 2009, Susan's two oldest children, Kirsty and James, made an appeal in tears at a press conference for anyone to help them with information on their mother, but nothing came of it. Going into 2010, Susan's father's dementia worsened to the point that he often forgot his daughter was missing. Her own daughter, Kirsty, had managed to shake her dependency on heroin in order to be there for the family, and they continued to push for her to be found. The police worked with the BBC to feature Susan's case on television appeals, and the family told stories of Susan to anyone who would listen, determined that the loving daughter, sister, mother, and grandmother would not be forgotten. Shelley Armitage was the next woman to vanish on April 2nd, 2010. Shelley was born to parents Daryl and Jill and was the oldest of three children. The family were very religious Roman Catholics and sent Shelley to an all-girls Catholic school, St. Joseph's, wanting to give her the best start in life. Shelley was not academically gifted, but she made up for that by being warm, friendly, big-hearted, and always willing to help and love anyone around her. She was constantly surrounded by a large group of friends who absolutely adored her. Shelley was acknowledged by all who knew her as being very beautiful, and she wanted to be a model. She would go into Bradford Centre and the nearby town of Huddersfield looking for modelling opportunities, trying to fulfil her dream. After leaving school at 16, Shelley got work in a bank and later a hairdressing salon. And it was around this time that she began to become involved with people in the drug scene in Bradford. When her parents became aware that Shelley was using, they paid for her to have multiple stints in rehabilitation, but unfortunately, she was unable to break free from her addiction. As her dependency worsened, she turned to sex work to fund it, working the streets to find clients. Shelley was well known among the other girls, and would take it upon herself to look after them all. If they had problems with a client or a pimp, Shelley would be the first one to step in and defend them. If they ever needed money, Shelley would share whatever she had. The girls knew her to be outgoing and loving, and also more than capable of sticking up for herself. In November 2009, Shelley was ready to break free from her addiction, and she'd signed herself up to a waiting list for a place at a charitable rehabilitation facility in Wales. However, a pending conviction for her came up at the same time the place in the rehab clinic did, and she deferred the place. She was due to be sentenced on May 17th, 2010, and perhaps after her sentence was fulfilled, she would be able to go to Wales for treatment after. Shelley did not attend her sentencing hearing, though, something that she would never have missed. On the 26th of April, she had gone out to look for work, but had not returned home. Her worried boyfriend, Craig Peterson, reported her missing to the police. She appeared on a public CCTV camera on the morning of the 26th, looking happy and well, but after that there were no further images of her. Police launched an investigation into her disappearance, making a public appeal after the first week, just as they had with Susan's case. Initially, despite the similarities between the two cases, they were investigated separately, and police circulated the CCTV footage of Shelley, missing posters, as well as interviewing hundreds of potential witnesses. Just like Susan, though, no news of Shelley ever came in. The third woman to disappear was Suzanne Blamires. Suzanne was 36 years old, daughter to Norman and Nikki. She was the oldest of three children, with a younger sister and brother. Norman was a very successful businessman, owning a chain of car dealerships. The family were wealthy, and the parents absolutely doted on their children, spoiling them at every opportunity with gifts, experiences, and things like owning their very own horses. The children were also very well behaved, however, so they weren't spoiled to the point of being brats. They were brought up as strict Roman Catholics and taught the value of education. Suzanne did very well at school, excelling through all of her exams and going on once graduating from sixth form to study nursing while working part-time in a care home for the elderly in order to gain experience. While at college, though, Suzanne discovered Leeds' rave scene and threw herself into the nightlife, wanting to try everything after her sheltered upbringing. She became involved with a man named Simon, and the two enabled one another in drug and alcohol use. Simon introduced Suzanne to cocaine and ecstasy. Norman hated Simon, but continued to support his daughter, buying the couple a house to live in and paying for their wedding reception when the pair married. Suzanne's well-being continued to decline after the wedding. She eventually became addicted to heroin, and when her attendance to college became too poor, she was removed from her nursing course. Her marriage to Simon fell apart, and her relationship with her family fractured to the point that she was no longer welcome in the family home, though her mother continued to try and help her where she could by giving her money. Sometimes Suzanne would be able to get off of the drugs for a short while, but eventually she would relapse. A romantic relationship with a small-time drug dealer, Ifti Hussein, brought crack into her life, and Hussein forced Suzanne into sex work to pay for his habit as well as her own. Hussein was physically violent towards her, and she buried herself deeper into drugs and alcohol in order to cope with the abuse. In December 2001, Norman died, and Suzanne was heartbroken by the loss of her father. Losing all hope in the wake of her grief, she was unable to escape the vicious, relentless abuse from Hussein. He hospitalised her multiple times, on one occasion breaking her leg, and on another occasion beating her so badly in the head that she lost consciousness for a prolonged period of time.
There are a lot of pieces of shit.
There are so many. This is the thing, you know, that somebody that's supposed to love you and look after you and just makes your life so much worse and takes advantage of you when you're in this awful, vulnerable position. You know, you've lost your daddy, and it does seem like she was a real daddy's girl, and he's gone, and they never got to resolve their issues before she lost him. And Ifti Hussein just doubled down on that and treated her worse and worse and worse. Such a scumbag.
What a dick.
What a dick. Another girl, Stacy, took Suzanne under her wing as much as she could, and the two became very close friends. Stacy would try to help Suzanne break away from her abusive relationship and would offer her a safe place to stay when she needed a bolt hole. The two shared a love of romantic comedy movies and the band N-Dubs, and they would look after one another when they were working, doing things like taking note of the registrations of any cars that each other got into and timing how long they were gone. Stacy recalls that all the memories she has of Suzanne are brilliant, happy ones, and considers her her best friend. On the 21st of May 2010, a little before midnight, Suzanne and Stacy were out working together as they had many times before. Stacy had to leave with a client and hugged Suzanne goodbye, not knowing it would be the last time that she would see her. When Suzanne did not return home as expected the following morning, Hussein rang Suzanne's mother to see if she was at the family house. When Nikki told him that she had not seen her daughter for several weeks, the two contacted the police to report her missing. At this point, the connections between the three missing women could no longer be ignored. The West Yorkshire police were certain that they had a serial killer loose in Bradford, and given their last disastrous investigation into the serial killings of sex workers by Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, they could not afford for history to repeat itself. So they did, at least at this point, learn from their previous cock-ups.
For once, they didn't actually drop a ball.
They actually did really good work on this investigation. I have to say that after the initial slight snafu, once they started to realise that they had a serial killer on their hands, they began to take it a lot more seriously. The failed Yorkshire Ripper inquiry had resulted in a number of changes to the policing system in Yorkshire, including the formation of the dedicated vice squad and the creation of the Home Office Large Major Inquiry System. The acronym for this computer system is HOMES, as in Sherlock Holmes. Yeah. This is a computerised cross-referencing system developed between West Yorkshire Police and IT experts. The officers in charge of the investigation into the three missing women were determined that these women were not to be thrown away because of their lifestyles, but that their disappearances be treated with all the weight that any other murder inquiry should be. Then the police got a lucky break. On Monday, the 24th of May 2010, 2 days after Suzanne had gone missing, the caretaker at the Homefield Court block of flats was reviewing the previous week's CCTV footage as he did every Monday morning. As he went through the hours of footage, he spotted something terrifying outside of flat 33. A woman fleeing the flat in the early hours of the morning on the 22nd of May, being pursued by Stephen Griffiths, who was wearing black leather gloves and his face contorted into a feral snarl. In his hands, he was raising a crossbow. Catching up with the woman, Griffiths threw her to the ground, then shot her twice at point-blank range through the skull in the back of the head with the crossbow, before he then dragged her lifeless form back into the flat. Afterwards, knowing he had been filmed, Griffiths came back out of the flat, approached the camera again, this time with the crossbow held high in one hand in a victorious stance, while he used the other to give the camera the finger. Over the next few hours on the CCTV footage, he was filmed again, coming out of the flat to hold a drinking glass up to the camera in a toast, and finally emerging from the flat with loaded black bin bags. Horrified by what he had seen on the footage, Peter Gee called the police. Sergeant Helen Metcalf, head of Bradford's vice squad, was familiar with the girls of Bradford's sex work scene and was able to identify the woman in the CCTV footage as Suzanne Blamers. At 4:50pm on the 24th of May, so same day, good job, around 60 armed police officers descended on Homefield Court. Though they had expected resistance from Griffiths, he was eerily calm when they broke down the door to flat 33, calling politely from within, "I'm here." When he was read his rights, as he was being charged for the assault on Suzanne Blamers, his only response to police was to say, "I'm Osama bin Laden."
Yes.
He's a weirdo.
Hmm. Oh, trying to play the crazy card.
Yeah, I think so. As we will see. Griffiths was taken into custody and police searched the flat, hoping to find Suzanne, Shelley and Susan still alive. But there was no sign of them. Once they were sure the women were not in prison there, the forensics team took over and pulled the flat apart. At Halifax Police Station, Griffiths was formally charged with the murder of Suzanne Blamires, and to officers' surprise, from the moment he was taken into an interrogation room, he began to confess freely to his crimes. He went into appalling detail about how he had murdered Suzanne, Shelley and Susan.
Did he try and say there was no body of evidence?
No. although he was familiar with that, with John George Hague, funnily enough. Yeah.
That's the thing I was thinking. Was that I'm Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, so if you're gonna play the I'm insane, I couldn't be in prison properly. But then you know of Martin Clunes.
John George Hague.
And how that didn't work.
Yeah. Well, he studied forensic psychology, don't forget, so he thought he was smarter than them. He's just a fanny.
Yeah.
He also claimed during the interrogation that he had killed many more women than those three. And he claimed that he cannibalised parts of the three women that police were searching for. He said that Susan, he had beaten to death with a hammer before dismembering her and burning her body in pieces. Some of the burning he did in his flat, some on a junk sofa outside the block. When asked why he'd set her remains on fire, he said it was so that he could destroy the DNA evidence. But he wasn't actually sure whether fire did in fact destroy DNA, and he'd meant to check it on the internet, but he hadn't got around to it. Pro tip. It doesn't. Setting fire to body parts in your flat.
The body of evidence, though.
Oh, apparently, this like the whole thing, unsurprisingly, filled with like thick black smoke, and he nearly suffocated in there.
Really?
Yeah, and that's when he decided that actually he should finish it off outside. And like the smell must have been unbelievable. And at that point, nobody reported anything.
It makes me think of the movie with what's his name? The guy that's in like every Michael Bay film.
I don't know. I don't like Michael Bay.
Oh. But it's a true story about a bunch of gym bros devising some big elaborate robbery plan. They kill someone, and they're like, you know what? So they can't track the body. We need to destroy the fingerprints. So they cut the hands off and they leave it to one of the guys to burn the fingerprints off. So he gets a barbecue.
Ew.
he tries barbecue.
This is a fictional film, yeah?
A true story.
Oh!
Yeah. The guy that done the barbecue was played by Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He tried barbecuing it inside the building. And it was like, it's too smoky and it's a really nice day. So he took it outside.
Ew.
He's standing there with the tongs turning them over.
Ew.
And this guy's doing roadworks down the road, like, what's that guy doing?
Ew!
Good film. Good
morons.
Soundtrack.
Well, yeah,
he's actually the guy that.
This is a real thing.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's only a small part of the story. But the fun thing is, the character that Dwayne Johnson plays, he's still in prison. For
good.
His part of it.
Good.
Oh no, actually no, he's not. He's not. Because he was only an accomplice.
Right. So accessory after the fact or whatever
yeah,
they call it.
But he wanted to make a point in the film because obviously he had to get his permission to use his likeness and character stuff. He wanted the film to make sure he was very, very, very sorry for what he'd done.
Really?
And he's actually in a gospel choir now. Yeah. He was a very soft bloke.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
Good film.
Mm.
Pain and Gain. We'll watch it sometime.
I'll have to look that up. Suzanne and Shelley, Griffiths claims, he had both shot with his crossbows before dismembering and dissecting them in his bathtub and then disposing of their body in various parts. While Griffiths was being interviewed, detectives found more video footage, this time on Griffiths' home computer. They found images of a naked, trussed-up woman in his bath, the words, "My sex slave," spray-painted on her back. Metcalf, the officer from the Vice Squad, was able to identify the woman as Shelley Armitage. I mean, it seems very, very likely that he tortured these women horribly. He killed them.
What a piece of shit.
Massive piece of shit. Griffiths showed no remorse or emotion of any kind, other than occasionally chuckling in amusement while he was interviewed. He continuously compared himself to other serial killers as he talked, delighting in pointing out all the ways to the police that he was superior to the people who had been caught before him. Police continued their search for Susan, Shelley and Suzanne, as well as collecting all of the forensic evidence they could. In total, they searched in excess of 130 locations around Bradford. So they were really thorough. I have to give props. I'm very quick to come down on shit police work. But in this case, the quality of the investigation really has to be praised. They did everything they possibly could to find these women. On the 25th of May 2010, by the River Aire, a member of the public found an abandoned rucksack. He picked it up and opened it to find it contained the decomposing remains of a human head. He called the police, and in the River Aire, forensics teams and diving officers retrieved several plastic bags that contained human remains. These were confirmed to be those of Suzanne Blamires. On the 29th of May, in the same river, they retrieved a suitcase that basically contained a kill kit. So it was full of loads of knives and hacksaws and tape and rope and everything you need basically to torture and mutilate someone.
How many of those knives were on his MySpace profile?
Probably loads, hopefully. Talk about, you know, just handing yourself over on a silver platter in terms of comparative evidence.
Yeah, well, it's like the, I'm going to go do Tesco's over.
Yeah. This is my knife. There are many knives, but this is mine. During this search, they also found plastic bags containing bones, which after testing were proved to be those of Shelley Armitage. Sadly, no remains of Susan Rushworth have ever been found. On the 28th of May 2010, while police were still conducting their searches, Griffiths made his first appearance in Bradford's Magistrates Court for his initial indictment hearing. When the court clerk asked Griffiths to confirm his name, his only answer was to insist that they called him the Crossbow Cannibal. Another one who gave himself his own nickname. After his hearing, Griffiths was taken to Wakefield Prison, the monster mansion that he was so obsessed with. He didn't have a very good time there.
I was going to say, who fucked him over then?
He gets the shit kicked out of him on the reg. On the June the 7th, 2010, a not guilty plea was entered by Griffiths' defence team, who attempted to begin mounting a defence strategy of Griffiths not being responsible for his crimes on the ground of diminished responsibility, aka crazy. The insanity plea. Yeah. And the case was set to go to trial. He was assessed by multiple psychiatrists, and during the period on the run-up to trial, he also made multiple suicide attempts. However, ultimately Griffiths surprised both his legal team and the court by changing his plea from not guilty to guilty. On December the 21st, 2010, he entered his guilty plea at Leeds Crown Court. It is thought by many that he did this because he did not want to lose the notoriety for his heinous crimes, because he might have committed them due to the fact that he was mad. So basically, he doesn't want to be found not guilty by reason of insanity. he wants all the props and all the notoriety and all the infamy of being an evil fucking bastard. He is so in love with himself, and all he wants to be is a big famous serial killer.
But he's just a piece of shit.
He's just a piece of shit. He's just a piece of shit. But just completely up his own art. It's just revolting. I hate him so much. Ugh. That same day, Griffiths was sentenced to a whole life order. This is really unusual in the UK. We don't get a lot of these. Basically, what this means is that he will be in prison until the day he dies without any possibility of parole. That's it. He was just, I just love this judge. The moment he confessed, like, he entered his guilty, he probably thought that he was going to get a lighter sentence. And the judge was like, no, fuck you. You are going away forever and ever and ever. Griffiths is currently imprisoned at HM Prison Longlaughton in Worcestershire, where he is despised by his fellow inmates, and they have tried to kill him multiple times, the most recent attempt being stabbing him with a sharpened wooden stake in February of 2019.
Oh.
Yep. He has also attempted more suicides and held hunger strikes, not in any protest against his own rights, but because he's so afraid of his other inmates, the only way to be put into isolation is to go onto hunger strike and be force-fed. They take him to the infirmary so that he's not picked on. Pew, pew, pew. To this day, Stephen Griffiths refuses to give any information on where Susan Rushworth's remains are. And again, this is something you see a lot with convicted serial killers. They will hold on to a victim because it's that last element of control, and it is just another way to torture the family members and the loved ones that are left behind.
Well, it's like the Moors murderers.
Yeah, that's exactly what they did. Griffiths is suspected of the murder of at least three more women, and Yorkshire police have reopened several cold cases that bear similarities to the murder of Susan, Shelley and Suzanne. But no concrete evidence has thus far been found to be able to bring charges against him. In the wake of the murders, David Cameron, former Prime Minister, made statements to the press that the murders warranted review of the current criminalisation of sex workers and the surrounding issues, such as the lack of resources available for those in the sex trade and those struggling with drug addiction. However, it is now almost 10 years to the day since those statements were made, and there have been no reviews or reforms made to the laws around sex work. They are currently offered no more protection than they were when they were being preyed on by Stephen Griffiths.
I think the only change has even remotely linked to that was when they tried to put in the decency laws around the porn industry. Basically banning bloody face it.
All they do is they make it harder and more dangerous for sex workers. Okay. You look at places like the Mustang Ranch and the Bunny Ranch and the legalized brothels in Nevada in the States.
From Lou Ferrigno's thing.
Of Lou Ferrigno, and also Penn & Teller's Bullshit. They did an excellent episode on it. These women are provided full medical care, full sexual protection, like resources, checkups, a safe place to operate, a safe place to live. You know, by legalizing sex work in these areas, in brothels specifically, they have created safe havens for these women who are able to do their job and know that if anything happens, there is somebody that's going to break down the door and beat the shit out of the client. There is going to be medical resources and, you know, things like condoms and contraception readily available to them. There are stringent policies in place about who is allowed to be a client. If you've got any sign of strange behaviour or sexual transmitted diseases, if the girls are just not happy with you for whatever reason, you know, they can turn you away. They've got things like regulated pricing structures so the girls know the income that they're going to receive.
Just for just for the context, people are wondering, what the fuck is she talking about? Where we learned this was from a TV series called Penn & Teller's Bullshit. Penn & Teller being the
amazing, amazing program. Highly recommend it.
They basically do series where they look into things that are bullshit. And they kind of...
They basically bust like social myths is probably the best way I can put it.
They get some kind of social myth and they pull it inside out and say, look, this is bullshit. Like designer water...
but they've got this incredible episode on the sex work industry, and they go and visit places like Mustang Ranch, which is an entirely legal brothel in Nevada and in these states.
And when that was made, that was the first of its kind, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there's 17 now, I believe, in the state.
And Louis Theroux is a very...
I think our listeners probably know who Louis Theroux is.
Well, you never know. We've got people across the world.
True, but most people in the true crime community know who he is.
Okay. But for those that don't know, he's a British documentary maker who he just winds up in places.
He's a bit of an oddball, isn't he? He's a professional oddball, but he's lovely.
He turns up at places, asks questions, and everyone just tells him whatever they want to know.
Yeah.
So if anything, he should probably be like a negotiator or something, because no one ever just doesn't tell him stuff.
Louis Theroux investigated Joe Exotic something like 8 years before Tiger King was ever a thing. There's a very good documentary of him visiting Joe Exotic Zoo, which I think you can find on Netflix. If you are fascinated by Joe Exotic in the same way I am, there's a bit more out there.
Carol Baskin's...
Fuck, don't you get sued? I'm going to cut that out.
Oh, beep it.
But anyway, the point of this is he also visited one of these legalized brothels.
Yep.
And the girls there are very well looked after. And because it's safe and legal, and they have policies like no drug use and no alcohol use while they have clients, but you have to be clean. They do regular drug testing and all that kind of thing. These women are basically given human fucking rights and allowed to operate their business in a way that keeps them safe. And at the end of the day, if you're saying in the UK, it is not illegal to exchange money for sex, but then you are making every safe way possible of doing so illegal, you are condemning these women. And I know it's not just women, but as I say, it's majority female sex workers out there. And it is majority female sex workers that you see turned up, you know, murdered and nobody cares, or assaulted and nobody does anything. The amount of times you see cases where, you know, these women have been raped, and not all officers, but some have turned around and said, you can't rape a sex worker. That is something that comes up all the time.
One of the problems that will come up in regards to... making laws that do make it safer for sex workers is the fact that with kind of the UK and Europe and stuff, and this is the one document, there is quite an issue with sex trafficking.
There's a huge issue with sex trafficking,
Because on one hand, yes, definitely make protections for people that are just doing a job that involves sex. On the other hand, you can't make it safe for sex traffickers.
No, but you can put in restrictions and guidelines like the legalized brothels in America. They have to pay taxes. All of the workers, in theory, or as far as I'm aware, are registered. It's a registered legalized business that is vetted by the IRS, and therefore there is a laser focus on it.
Yeah.
So why can that not be the case in the UK? Why can we not offer these women something? Why is it that two women in a house together are judged at a brothel? You can't even have your mate with you.
Because this is the UK, and a man was fined £800 for making a video of his pug putting his paw up.
Yeah. It's literally, let's be honest, and I've seen it in quotes in my research in this, it's because it's quote-unquote morally repugnant. If it's two consenting adults, it is their business and nobody else's. I'm very angry about all of this.
Yeah.
I'm very angry that nothing has changed.
Yeah. And if these girls had a safe environment.
Yeah, and they had somebody with them. Today. There needs to be massive overhaul in terms of legislation around sex work, in terms of sex work criminalisation, in terms of, quite frankly, what's the government's fucking business and what it isn't.
Yeah. But unfortunately, with a lot of things in 2020, it's probably not going to get discussed for a
right?
bit. Because the fact
and people who... like Stephen Griffiths are going to be allowed to carry on doing things like that. This is the problem. So furious. So furious. Anyway, I need to step away from this because I'm getting really, really cross. Can I have a criminally stupid,
You can
please?
Have a criminally stupid...
Sophia, and I just want to say, if you agree with any of my stances, maybe consider writing to your local MP.
Ricky Hodgkins was out one night. He really, really wanted a drink.
What? Like a normal drink or an alcoholic?
He wanted a drinky poo.
A drinky poo.
He wanted a drinky poo.
A little drinky poo.
And he decided, you know what? The best way for me to get a drink right now is to break into the shop at Margate Railway Station.
Oh my god. Oh, Margate.
Yeah.
Blimey, I used to get them as kids.
Now, there's CCTV of this.
Good.
He basically broke into this place face first, fell onto the floor, got up, dusted himself off, and then helped himself to a whole ton of booze. Later that night, police found him pretty much in a heap on the floor, surrounded by empty booze bottles.
Oh my god.
In a pool of his own blood.
Oh!
And,
oh.
They were like, what happened here, sunshine? And he's like, this is my drink. I'm bloody because I got in a fight earlier tonight.
Oh,
and the police were like, you know what, we're in Kent, that's very likely. And while they're discussing this, they're like, you know what? It could be on. He could be telling the truth. Let's get this fella home.
Okay.
To which he goes, excuse me, officer. Before you do that, can I go back into the shop and get my bag?
Oh, oh my God.
So they're out looking for this guy that broke into the shop. They found this fella on the floor, surrounded by booze bottles, covered in blood. So, you know, there's a few reasons to think that this guy's responsible. But then he goes, by the way,
I've left my backpack.
I left my backpack in that place to go back.
Oh, bless it.
Unsurprisingly, he got arrested.
Bless his cottons.
Yeah.
What a silly boy.
And that is today's criminally stupid.
Oh, lovely. Is there CCTV available?
Yeah.
I'll put it up on the Facebook group like I did with the bus one. Oh, what a silly, silly boy.
Yeah.
Oh, well, thank you very much for listening, everybody. If this one has come out ever so slightly late, I'm really, really sorry. I'm just so tired. I fell asleep. I'm exhausted. And if you would like to interact with us on social media, you can follow us on Twitter at DeviantCrimePod. You can follow us on Instagram at DeviantCrimePodcast. And you can join us on our Facebook group. You can find us by searching Deviant, a True Crime Podcast. You can also email us at deviantcrimepodcast@gmail.com. We are looking to hopefully start doing listener episodes in the future with your stories. We think that would be something really enjoyable for us all, hopefully. Yeah. And ideally, we would like to try and fit as many of those stories in. So we're probably looking at maybe an hour for our listener episodes. So get them in if you've got criminally stupid, if you've got your own true crime stories, if you've got your own, I don't know, near misses, if you've got any stories that you want to tell us that you think we might find interesting or horrifying. Send them our way because we will read them all. And we really want to do a listener episode if we can and read as many stories as we possibly can, because there's nothing worse than sending a story off to a podcast that you love and knowing the chances are it is never, ever going to be on air. So if you think that is something that you would like to hear, please send us your tales.
And if you fancy, say which of us you want us to read it.
Yeah, we can request. Send us your case suggestions. Send us anything you like. Send us
guinea pigs.
Angry rants about the state of the current legislation on sex workers in the UK or where you live. Send us copies of letters that you have sent to your local political representative demanding change, if that's something you do. We want to hear from you. We love you. We think you're fabulous. You make us happy.
And also, tell us your favourite ice cream, and it should be pistachio. If not, you're wrong.
Yes, anything you want, basically. We just want to hear from you. If you could also please rate, review and subscribe. Tell your mates if you like us and you think that they might too. We would really appreciate it. It's the only way that would really help us grow and help us improve. So if you think that we have any sort of value to offer somebody else, please let them know and point them in the right direction. Anything else?
Also, just a for advance warning, because we are going to be moving house, we might be pre-recording some episodes. So if you're listening and wondering, why isn't this correction being read out or things like that, it's because we've banked them.
Yeah, so we will get around to them, but don't be surprised if we become a little bit less topical and responsive to any messages and things that you send us. We will catch up once we are in Scotland.
We want to keep a schedule.
Yep. 3 weeks to go.
Woo! Right. I think we've dragged the ending on
yes.
a fair bit. Thanks for listening.
Take care of yourself. Be kind to each other. And yeah, write to your local MP if you're in the UK and demand change.
All right. Let's end it now. Bye.
Bye, everybody.